Welcome to the Back in Time podcast with Kyle and JD, where every week we jump into our DeLorean, cruise to 88 miles per hour, and travel back in time to review our favorite films. Every week we talk about current cinema, the latest trailers, and we pick a new favorite film every single episode.
But I need a nuclear reaction to generate the 1.21 gigawatts of electricity.
1.21 gigawatts!
Don't say that! Never say that! Goonies never say die!
We're the best! We're the beautiful! We're the only!
Now, here's your host, Kyle Autry, and his co-host, JD.
Welcome to the Back in Time podcast. I am your host, Kyle Autry, joined, as always, by my co-host, JD. JD, how are you, man?
Snapping and slapping.
All right, man. You ready to jump into some Candyman this week?
Yeah, dude. I really, really am looking forward to talking about this movie.
Yeah, get your beehive ready. Pull out your bread, put a little honey on it. Let's dive in.
I'm slathered in honey right now, ready to go.
And this is going to be a two-part episode. So the first episode is going to take place on our podcast. And then when we hit the break, we're going to be joined by the guys from Black Cat Shadow. But before we jump into this week's episode of Candyman, let's fire up the DeLorean, go back to last week and talk about Independence Day. JD, what was your feedback on the episode?
Dude, I'm just so happy that everybody still loves Independence Day. I'm still yet to really meet anyone that doesn't like it. And, you know, nothing but positive feedback and love for this movie.
Yeah, I heard nothing but great things as well. And I think it was a really fun episode. And it's really perfect timing with 4th of July being last week. And we put out the both episodes, you know, in and around 4th of July. So I just think it was good timing and glad that everybody enjoyed it. And, you know, as always, make sure if you guys are listening to the episode to interact with us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Everything is at Back in Time Pod, or you can just search for Back in Time Podcast on Facebook and tell us what you think about the episode. Let us know what you didn't like, what we can improve on, and that way we can continue to grow and get better every episode. JD, let's jump into what's coming down the pipeline.
Hey, I'm freezing my butt off here. There's cold air coming from the event.
Yeah, we froze the pipes. We're going for a little ride.
So every week, we preview what's coming down the pipeline for our show and what's coming into theaters. So hitting theaters this week, we have the animated film Hotel Transylvania 3 Summer Vacation. We also have the latest from Dwayne The Rock Johnson as he stars in Skyscraper, about an FBI hostage rescue team leader and former U.S. veteran whose job is to access security for skyscrapers. JD, do you have any interest in either of the big releases this week?
I'm kind of surprised that Hotel Transylvania Part 3 would be considered a big release. I didn't know there was a Part 1 or a Part 2.
In the animated world, it's a big movie. It'll probably actually outdo Skyscraper. Box office wise.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised by that. Skyscraper is a movie that I want to see. I know I will be seeing it opening weekend. Probably be a Redbox or Vudu for me eventually after having forgotten about it for 8 weeks and then seeing it magically appear.
Okay. I did read that it's tracking to be the best live action movie of the year so far. So I guess it's supposed to be a little bit of a sleeper hit.
What are they comparing it against as a live-action movie?
I don't know. I did not read that part. I just read the headline.
I mean, are they considering something like Infinity War not live-action because it's CGI'd or just because it's a comic book? Or like, I mean, you can get so specific with the different niches of each movie's genre that every movie's going to eventually be the best in its own separate category.
Right. That's a good point. I'll have to read the article and get back to you on that. So I am looking forward to Skyscraper. I love The Rock. He's great. Obviously a big wrestling fan. Listeners know that by now. But I'm also excited to see Neve Campbell back in a pretty big blockbuster movie. We haven't seen much of her since she left the Scream franchise. Looking forward to seeing how she does here.
She's always got skills. She was never lacking.
No. What's your favorite Neve Campbell movie, and why is it Wild Things?
Jeez, Wild Things. I've got a funny story about that movie.
Let's talk about our show for a second. On the podcast coming up this week, we're going to be discussing I Know What You Did Last Summer. JD, let's tease it here real quick. What do you look forward to most when we dive into I Know What You Did Last Summer?
I Know What You Did Last Summer is easily as definitive a movie to the 90s as Scream is. I think that it goes in a much different direction. But in terms of what this was, 1997 when it came out,
got to be in that range. I haven't looked yet.
I mean, what, we're 12, 13, maybe 14 years old. Like, this defines what I thought high school was supposed to be like before we were even there.
You mean running people over and getting chased by crazy people with slickers and hooks?
Oh, yeah. Like, that's how I lived my high school days, and it's based on this movie.
Okay. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I haven't actually watched the movie in quite a while, and it's in my DVD collection, and I'm going to dust it off and see what it still has.
No, I think we're going to have a lot of fun with that one. I know, you know, episode of Scream back in our archives was a great, great episode, great time. And I think that this is going to be a pretty lively debate. I think that there's more room to really empathize with the actors and to kind of criticize some of the corny performances.
Yeah, there's going to be plenty of those. Well, that's it for what's coming down the pipeline. Let's jump into our next segment. Oh, wow.
Wow. Flippers and all. Wow.
Wow.
Wow. This is a nice boat.
Wow. I sort of got screwed on the old bedroom selection. Every room's like four times as big as mine.
So, JD, if you don't mind, I'm going to take it first this week, since I think you got it last week. I'm going to give you my oh, wow of the week. So, now, just to give some context here, it's Monday when we're recording this episode, a week before this actually comes out. So my oh wow moment is relative to what's going on right now today. A lot of NBA free agencies. We saw LeBron James sign with the Los Angeles Lakers. That was a big oh wow for me. But then, you know, I start to see, you know, some stuff happening with my Chicago Bulls, and they've done absolutely nothing. So it looks like it's going to be another terrible year for Chicago basketball. And that really bums me out, man. I miss the 90s when we were winning titles and we were the talk of the town.
Yeah, those were the days, man. Way back when. Those were the days.
Yeah, I mean, I was just wearing Bulls jerseys and rocking Jordan shoes.
Yeah, yeah, you son of a bitch. Go ahead and rub it in.
I have to, man. That's kind of our thing on the show. How about you, man? Any oh wow moments for you?
I don't know if it's necessarily an oh wow moment, but I did make it around to seeing Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. And I guess my response was, oh wow, how the hell did that get approved? How did that get made? How did anybody sign off on any of that?
Okay, so you did not like Fallen Kingdom. If anybody listened to our review in the archives I did with my wife, I did enjoy it for what it is. They basically remade Lost World, which I also enjoyed in that you also hate it.
Yes. And, you know, I'll give it the credit. And, you know, you both did an excellent job in your review of the movie. There were redeemable moments. It was worth the price of admission. You know, it was enjoyable. There was a lot to see. There was a lot to take in. I ate a bucket of popcorn. You know, I had the butter poops for the next day, but if we're talking about, you know, the nitty gritty of the story, like I just, you know, just sat there and like there was one part where I about walked out of the theater because it was just so like astronomically stupid. It might have been, I don't know. I don't want to get into any spoilers, so I'm just going to zip my mouth shut. See the movie, don't see the movie. You're not going to miss anything either way. Stick to the original. There's a reason why anytime you see anybody wearing a t-shirt from the Jurassic franchise, it's a Jurassic Park shirt. I don't think I've ever seen anyone wearing a Jurassic World shirt.
They do sell them, but yeah, you're right. I definitely have two different Jurassic Park t-shirts. And they're all, yeah, they're both from the original. So you are correct, sir. Awesome. So that'll wrap it up for our oh wow moments of the week. We're going to take a quick bathroom break, and we'll be back on the other side with our friends from Black Cat Shadow, Andy and Dave, as we talk all things Candyman.
Wait a minute, what are you doing, Don?
I need fuel.
Hey, I'm Andy.
And I'm Dave.
And we're with the Black Cat Shadow Horror Movie Podcast.
We're doing a two-part episode with the Back in Time Podcast where we talk about Candyman.
Hey, Dave, you know, the Candyman movie, you know, has that urban legend about saying the name five times in a front of a mirror. It kind of reminds me of that Bloody Mary legend. Have you ever done that?
No, man, I don't really believe in legends, so I'll tell you what, man. I'm not even afraid to do it.
Yeah, we're right in front of a bathroom mirror right now.
Well, then we should do it.
All right. I guess I'll start. Candyman.
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 All right, let's say it together.
Okay, we'll do it on three. You count.
One, two, three. Candyman. Hey, you didn't say it.
I'm not saying that crap.
Oh, great. You're going to leave me to deal with Mr. Tony Todd.
I came for you.
All right, welcome back from our bathroom break, and I want to welcome to the show Andy and Dave from Black Cat Shadow. Andy, how are you this evening?
Hey, I'm doing great. Glad to be on back on the Back in Time podcast again.
Yeah, man, excited to have you back. Dave, how are you, bud?
What's up, guys?
Yeah, if you guys remember, we had Black Cat Shadow on a two-part episode way back in February, earlier in the year. And we covered A Nightmare on Elm Street on our podcast. And then we did part two, Freddy's Revenge, on theirs in the archives. It's good to have you guys back on. Fill us in on what's been going on with Black Cat Shadow since February. Andy, why don't you take that one?
Yeah, well, did some interviews and talked about some cool movies. We did an interview with Victor Miller, the screenwriter for the original Friday the 13th. So that was cool. And we had a chat episode where it was me.
Oh, you're talking about Tyler.
Mike, Tyler, from the Horror Pod Class, and we all, you know, talked about the Friday the 13th franchise, which ones were our favorite and all that kind of good stuff. It was fun. Last month, we took part in that big Universal Monsters crossover, and we did an episode on the Wolfman, and that was a lot of fun. And then to start off last month, we interviewed a filmmaker by the name of Philippe Mora, and he did some movies by the name of Howling 2 and 3, and he also did a creature feature classic called The Beast Within. Yeah, so, you know, we stay pretty busy over there. It's having a lot of fun.
That's awesome. And Dave, I know you've started your own podcast since we last had you guys on in February, and you've been on here for Sandlot. I've been on your show. It's called Dave's Pop Culture Podcast. Tell our listeners a little bit about the show and what you have coming up this month, because I'm personally pretty excited.
Yeah, so Dave's Pop Culture Podcast was just my brainchild podcast because you can only do so many episodes for one podcast, and I just wanted to keep recording. So I told Andy, I'm going to start a side gig, and I don't want to leave Black Cat, but I just want to go over here and just keep rambling on. He's like, do your thing, bro. So I started Dave's Pop Culture Podcast, and it's funny that you mentioned I didn't have that podcast when I was on your show last because I'm already on episode 31.
Yeah, I know. I just keep rolling. Crank them out.
I actually just released one about 30 minutes ago where Andy came on the show and we talked about the 1983. It's a movie called The Being. It's a sci-fi horror film and it's pretty crazy, man. It's a good one. But yeah, that's awesome. For the month of July, the whole point of my podcast is to not only just do horror, but it's also science fiction, comic books, cartoons, general conversation topics with cool people. The idea is that I'm so scatterbrained that I have to have a podcast that's also scatterbrained, and it allows me to do whatever I want. And I decided for the month of July, I'm going to carry a theme of Judy Garland. So I'm going to be deep dive, kind of like you guys do, into four Judy Garland films. And I haven't released what those are, even though Kyle hit me up pretty quick. I think he was probably the first person to download that episode and asked me if I just so happened was going to cover one. And I had to tell him yes, because I wasn't going to lie to him. But needless to say, there's going to be some great Judy Garland movies this month.
If anybody heard the whistle there, they might have a little teaser of what it is. But yeah, I'm sure you can guess. But yeah, that's exciting, man. I'm glad you guys are all doing well. And everybody's been just cranking away since February, and here we are a little bit later in the year. Now, let's get into the reason we're here. We're here to talk some Candyman, which is a 1992 American supernatural slasher film written and directed by Bernard Rose. And it's based on a short story, The Forbidden, by Clive Barker, who also served as executive producer on this film. It stars Virginia Madsen, Tony Todd, Xander Berkeley, and the plot follows a grad student, Madsen, completing a thesis on urban legend, who encounters the legend of Candyman, an artist and son of a slave who had his hand severed and then was murdered. It was released by TriStar and did pretty well theatrically. It has about a 70% approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes, and it grossed over $25 million worldwide, which you can go to our teaser trailer episode and get all the numbers, and we'll break things down more in detail there. Film soundtrack was composed by Philip Glass, who also subsequently was recognized this as a classic score. There's a couple sequels. I know we're going to get into that on your guys' podcast, but Dave, you know, this was kind of your idea here. Maybe it was both you and Andy, but you know, why do you want us to get into Candyman? What do you love about this movie?
Well, actually, the reason that I thought Candyman would be a good idea, because I remember it was one of the options in your poll, and yes, Nightmare on Elm Street destroyed everything. But I saw some responses of people saying, I wish it had been Candyman. And I was like, well, I haven't seen Candyman in like 6 years since I showed it to my son. And I actually like part one and two of that. Hey, guys, let's do, instead of doing Nightmare on Elm Street 3 and 4, you guys want to do Candyman 1 and 2? And luckily, everybody was on board.
You almost said one too many Candymans there.
Oh, be careful. Luckily, there's no vanity here. I don't have a mirror around me.
You know, JD, we talked a little bit about it on the teaser trailer, but yeah, I mean, going back and rewatching this for the first time in a long time without giving away any spoilers, which we'll cover in the review, what do you think of the Candyman start of the franchise?
Yeah, I don't want to spout off too soon. I was a little disappointed in this viewing. This is a movie that I've probably seen, you know, 3, 4, maybe 5 times throughout my life. I like to pop it in every now and then and sort of refresh my memory. It gives me a lot of fond memories of growing up in Chicago. But, you know, I really appreciate what they were trying to do. And I think Clive Barker is an excellent, you know, he's an excellent writer. He's an excellent storyteller. Everything from Hellraiser to Midnight Meat Train, he's done a great job. And I think that there's a lot of greatness captured in Candyman. I just really fear that it's the product of coming out in 1992.
Okay. Andy, your response to that?
You know, I actually like this one. I really dug the story a lot. I love the urban legend, like, you know, roots of this movie. And, you know, I love the setting. You know, here we see, you know, oftentimes we hear about folklore, but here we actually get to see urban legend. You know, we get to see folklore, but from an urban setting. And I think that's really interesting, especially in the setting of, you know, the projects there. And there's just a lot, I feel like there's probably a lot of social commentary that could be said, you know, just based on the setting and just some of the characters. So, yeah, it's an interesting movie. I will say it's on the slow side. I didn't quite mind. But I think, you know, some people may expect this to be like another Freddy or Jason, because I think, you know, when the movie came out, those two franchises were kind of on the decline. And I think some people were looking to Candyman to be like a new icon in horror. And I don't think he really fit that mold as much as people expected.
Okay. Let's go around the table real quick. Dave, do you believe in urban legends?
Oof. You hit me with a hard one. I don't know, man. I want to, but I'm kind of the same guy who's like seeing is believing. So I'm just going to say no.
Okay. Andy, do you believe in urban legends?
Well, I think maybe at some point there was some truth to, like, you know, to any folklore or something. I feel like, it, you know, there's like a little bit of truth in it. But I think it's like just like that telephone game you play when you're a kid. Like the first person will tell their experience and then it'll just get passed down the line. And by the time it gets to the end, it's like this super exaggerated story. So,
yeah,
you know, most of the stories I take with a grain of salt. I don't really put too much credence in, but it is interesting to explore, you know, like where those came from though.
Okay. JD, I don't think I've ever asked you. How about you?
I think you know what my answer is going to be, and I appreciate what both Andy and Dave said, because I totally invest in, you know, believe half of what you see and none of what you hear. I was an avid ghost hunter in high school and in college. Like, that was one of my favorite activities. And I've got some pretty freaky stories from stuff that we experience. So I 100% believe in urban legends. I say the truth is there, and it's going to spook the hell out of us.
Okay. I love it. I'm with Andy and Dave on here. Same opinion. I think it's just an extended version of a small story that just gets out of control at some point. It's too many Chinese telephones.
Oh, you guys are no fun at all.
Well, yeah, I will say that I'm a believer in, like, the unexplained, and I love that kind of stuff. And Justin, I definitely identify with what you're saying about, like, ghost hunting and stuff. That stuff fascinates me. And so as far as that kind of stuff goes, I don't say that ghosts and things like that and Bigfoot don't exist, because I don't think I really have, like, enough experience to have, like, a definitive answer. But I don't think really anybody does. I am really fascinated by those things, though.
Okay. Good feedback. I love that we get into urban legends here, but let's go ahead and jump into the full review. The movie begins with the camera zooming in on a nest of bees, and we hear a voiceover from a woman's voice. She says, "This is the scariest story she's ever heard, and it's totally true. It happened in Indiana. Claire was babysitting for the Johnson, and Billy pulls up on his motorcycle." We actually see Billy come into the house, and she says, "Have you ever heard of Candyman?" He says, "No." She explains, "His right hand is sawed off and he has a hook in the bloody stump. You repeat Candyman 5 times and he will appear in the mirror, breathing down your neck." Billy gets to 4 on the Candyman count, then kisses her in the neck. She tells him to go wait downstairs for her. She's got a surprise. But she goes back to the mirror and says, "Candyman one more time." The light goes off, and he quickly appears, and we just see a blood splatter, some loud noises, and the camera pans out, and you see two girls talking, and they're recording the conversation. JD, what do you think of the opening scene here, and already the first death within minutes?
Yeah, and I alluded a little earlier to my overall thoughts on this movie, but I think this is a great opening scene. It does almost like a postmodern introduction to the story that we're going to get, with the voiceover, and we've got the sort of old school looking couple, and the guy's on his motorcycle, and then boom, blood splatter. Like, I was so invested in this opening scene. I think it's a great hook, pun intended.
We enter a college classroom next. Our main character, Helen, enters and sits down. She's played by Virginia Madsen. Dave, are you a fan of Virginia Madsen outside of this Candyman role?
Yeah, I think that she did a fine job in this movie, and I actually asked myself that question earlier. I was like, man, you don't see her enough. But when you look her up and you start to see some of the appearances that she's been in, talent runs in her family, and I not only love her in this movie, but yeah, I'm a fan because I loved her in Haunting in Connecticut.
Yeah, that's a really good one. I love that one. One of the interesting facts, and I didn't actually have that section in the podcast because I wanted to bring him up throughout, on the film's DVD commentary, producer Alan Pohl said that Madsen, had she been unable to step into the role of Helen, that part would have likely been offered to Sandra Bullock, who was still a relative unknown actress at that point. Dave, do you think that would have affected her career positively or negatively, especially considering the nude scenes?
Yeah, I really can't see anybody else playing the role in the 1990s. I'm not saying that she was amazing in this, but when you say Sandra Bullock and I put her in those shoes, minus nothing to look at in the bathtub, I don't feel that same effect is there. And especially as we get into the later half of the film, I think that's when her chops really shine, and she plays psychotic better than anybody.
We find out that Virginia is not a student, but the wife of Professor Trevor. She's mad about him telling more urban legends and says he was supposed to hold off until next semester. In her classroom, she's typing notes when the janitor enters. She overhears the recording. Let's listen to our first clip here of Virginia and the janitor.
Candyman, huh?
Yes, have you heard of him?
Mm-hmm. You doing a study on him?
Yes, I am. What have you heard? Everybody's scared and wants to get dark. You live over at Cabrini. My friend told me about it.
Cabrini Green?
Yeah, in the projects. I live on the south side, so I don't know too much about it, but my friend, she know all about it. Her cousin live at Cabrini. They say he killed the lady.
Can I talk to your friend?
Sure. Kitty?
Yeah, what do you want?
Lady down here want to talk to you.
Where?
She coming.
I'm Helen Lyle.
Pleased to meet you. Henrietta Mosley. And this is Kitty Culver.
Nothing.
Tell her what you told me about the Candyman.
Well, all I know was there was some lady in a tub and she heard a noise.
Do you remember her name?
I think her name was Ruthie Jean. And she heard this banging and smashing like somebody was trying to make a hole in a wall. So Ruthie called 911 and she said there's somebody coming through the walls. And they didn't believe her.
They thought the lady was crazy, right?
Mm-hmm. So she called 911 again, and they still didn't believe her. But when they finally got there, she was dead.
Was she shot?
No. She was killed with a hook. Yeah.
It's true. Yeah, it is. I read it in the papers. Candyman killed her.
Andy, we're starting to get more pieces to the puzzle here. What do you think of this storyline and what the two janitors had to say?
Oh, I thought it was a pretty cool scene because, you know, it's a perfect example of like how urban legends get spread. You know, you meet somebody like, and then whenever they're telling you this story, they're like, oh yeah, I have a friend that this happened to, or it's my friend's cousin's brother's stepmother that this happened to, you know? So it's really cool that, you know, that they were able to, she was actually able to talk to the person. Well, I guess not exactly the person that experienced it, but it was just cool to see that process of her hearing the story from them. It's a great setup, you know, for the rest of the movie, I think, just to lead her to find out more about Candyman.
One of the parts of the book, or I should say the short story that's different from the actual movie, is the story took place in Liverpool, England, and they switched it to Cabrini Green Public Housing Development near Chicago on the north side. JD, you're an Illinois kid. I know you didn't grow up too far from Chicago. Did you ever end up in Cabrini Green?
Yeah, no. So I'm born and raised in Chicago in some shitty neighborhoods. And there's been times when we drove past. You don't drive through Cabrini Green, but I mean, it's a neighborhood and an area much like Gary, Indiana or Detroit, where you don't stop at stop signs or stoplights. You go, you know, like you just... you avoid it. I mean, there was some old Comiskey Park used to be near a bunch of projects, and it was really dicey even going to see the White Sox play growing up.
Yeah, so I've got a story that goes along with that. So when I was in high school, I went to a concert in Chicago. I think we went to the Metro or House of Blues, and we ended up getting lost on the way home. Luckily, cell phones were a thing at this point, so my friend calls his mom, and she's like, where are you guys at? We're like, hold on, we're coming up on a sign. Says, welcome to Cabrini Green. She says, do not stop the car. Go through every stoplight and every stop sign and get your ass out of there now. They've since torn down and demolished the last of the buildings. I think that happened in 2009 or 2011. It's actually quite nice there now. It's kind of upscale, high-rise buildings. But that was my first and only encounter in Cabrini Green. So to go along with your story, yeah, you don't stop there. And if you're ever in Gary, don't stop there either. Helen and Bernie are looking at the newspaper clippings. One is from Cabrini Green. Bernie comments that she would never even drive past there. I heard a kid got shot there the other day. Helen says, every day they get shot. They go into the bathroom and remove the mirror. And they both say Candyman five times in the bathroom mirror. But when they laugh and walk out, nothing happens. Later that night, Helen is laying in bed when her husband Trevor jumps into bed, scaring the crap out of her. Dave, what'd you think of this cheap scare here?
Yeah, it's kind of funny because when they do the Candyman thing in the mirror, you're like, why did nothing happen? And I can't remember if they even said it five times, even though I rewatched this thing this morning. I don't find myself counting it. But when nothing happened, I was like, aw. And then so they switch, and now she's laying in bed, and then you don't see who it is, but then you put two and two together. Somebody dives in bed and grabs her. And my first thought was like, that better not be Candyman doing that, you know? And when you see it's her, I'm going to say loser boyfriend, it's all the better because I just, if I tried that, I would probably get punched.
Okay. Is it her boyfriend or husband? I don't know if I ever got that or not. I think they have the same last name.
Yeah, it is probably husband, because I remember some scenes where she has a wedding ring on, and I remember thinking, why would she still have a ring on in that scene? So, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, they're both last name is Lyle. Good.
Well, he's a Lyler. How about that?
So Helen and Bernie arrive in the projects of Cabrina Green. The ladies are followed all the way up to the apartment building. The guys are whistling at them, and they even say that they're the 5-0, which is code name for the police in the projects. They continue through the complex, taking photos of graffiti. Helen enters into a dark, creepy room, and she's taking photos of everything. Bernie is uncomfortable as she waits, and Helen enters this room, and painted on the other side of the wall is an open mouth and a man, and I assume that's Candyman, but we don't know yet. She finds some drugs on the ground and then exits. Not a lot going on here yet. Andy, what'd you think of this scene?
Oh, it was great, man. I think that just the setting really helps build the suspense. You know, as they enter Cabrini Green, and you know, it's cool that they actually film there. You know, they film the exteriors and, you know, the buildings, and I guess, you know, I was reading some trivia and they had to like make a deal with the gangs there to let them film. it's pretty crazy, but man, this scene where they first enter those buildings and they're looking through those old abandoned apartments, and it's gross. And I guess the actual apartment was a set. So the set that they built was really cool. And, you know, like that graffiti of Candyman was really awesome. They did a great job with that. Yeah, I liked it a lot.
Yeah, that's a great point that you made up that, yeah, this was actually shot in Cabrina Green, which by itself could just be a horror movie. Just trying to survive that place. Now, later that night, Bernie and Helen are out for dinner and they're meeting up with some professors. One of the professors asked them about their research and they explained it's not quite ready. And he asked if they've read his report, the one he did on Candyman. And let's listen in here as the professor describes some of his research.
The legend first appeared in 1890. Candyman was the son of a slave. His father had amassed a considerable fortune from designing a device for the mass producing of shoes after the Civil War. Candyman had been sent to all the best schools and had grown up in polite society. He had a prodigious talent as an artist and was much sought after when it came to the documenting of one's wealth and position in society in a portrait. Well, it was in this latter capacity that he was commissioned by a wealthy landowner to capture his daughter's virginal beauty. Well, of course, they fell deeply in love, and she became pregnant. Poor Candyman. He paid a pack of brutal hooligans to do the deed. They chased Candyman through the town to Cabrini Green, where they proceeded to saw off his right hand with a rusty blade. And no one came to his aid. But this was just the beginning of his ordeal. Nearby, there was an apiary. Dozens of hives, filled with hungry bees. They smashed the hives and stole the honeycomb and smeared it over his prone, naked body. Candyman was stung to death by the bees. They burned his body on a giant pyre and then scattered his ashes over Cabrini Green.
JD, what'd you think of the description of Candyman?
I think it's a really cool backstory that they establish, and they do it in a unique way to have this sort of like round table of intellectuals just discussing out of this world urban legends. I mean, it's a little on the nose exposition wise for me, but I think it's important to push the story forward, and it does it in a good way that's better than having them in a classroom setting or somebody reading an internet article or whatever the hell people did in 92.
Yeah, the guy's a little stuffy for me. I don't like his Candyman. Gosh, loosen up, guy. But anyway, Helen is talking with a little boy named Jake next outside of Anna Marie's apartment. The little boy says he can't say nothing or Candyman will get me. He tells Helen that you're crazy for walking around here alone. She says that she doesn't scare easy, and she says, "You can just show me. You don't have to tell me." He leads Helen outside and takes her to an outside bathroom. He tells Helen a story about a little boy who was killed in this bathroom. She asked if it was Candyman who did it, and he says yes. She goes into the bathroom. Smells terrible. She's gagging. She's covering her mouth. She opens a toilet, and thousands of bees are just inside of it, swarming around. Outside, Jake is approached by a very tall man. He turns around and says, "Candyman." Inside, Helen is still looking around and snapping photos, and the man enters with two other guys. One goes behind Helen and restrains her. The tall man with a hook enters and says, "We hear you looking for Candyman, bitch." And then apparently he knocks her out cold, but we don't see it. JD, what'd you think of this scene?
Best quote of the movie right there. "We hear you're looking for Candyman, bitch." And then he cold cocks her. Yeah. Fantastic. I understand a lot of the subtext that this movie is trying to do and what it's trying to represent, and the fact that, and I think this scene does a great job of establishing the real physical fear that Cabrini Green is versus the fictional, in quotes, world of who Candyman is and what that represents. So it's a good juxtaposition between the two.
One of the interesting facts I had, the bees that we see throughout this film are not CGI. Of course, in 92, they really don't have that technology for that type of amount of bees. And the bees play a key role in Candyman. The filmmakers used newborn bees that were only 12 hours old, so they looked fully grown, but they had less powerful stingers. Tony Todd was reportedly stung 23 times and got a bonus each time it happened. I thought that was pretty cool. I wonder how much his bonus was, though. We have a police lineup next with several men. They're looking to find out which one had hit Helen. Several of them step forward and say, "We hear you're looking for Candyman, bitch." She identifies the one who knocked her out as number 5 in the lineup. And she's got a pretty gnarly black eye here. Dave, what do you think of this scene?
I remember when that sequence had happened, I was a little nervous because I think she got really lucky that that's all that happened. But she did get the daylights knocked out of her. I mean, that it's funny. The last time you brought me on here, we talked about somebody who got cold clocked in the eye with a baseball. And so maybe they should have just put a stake on there, you know, to help her out. But needless to say, and also the phrase itself is hilarious, like JD was talking about. But isn't that like a straight Freddy Krueger thing you would expect?
No, I totally agree with you, man. Like, yeah, it sounds like a total Freddy phrase. And it also reminds me of "I'm the Juggernaut, bitch."
There you go. Perfect.
Outside, Jake is angry in the hallway. He said it was supposed to be our secret. Now Candyman gonna get me. She assures him that Candyman isn't real and he will be safe. Several days later, Helen is back at Illinois University. Bernie gives her the photographs a friend of hers was able to salvage. After the film was smashed, Helen is walking to the car next, and we see the bottom feet of someone approaching her. She hears a booming voice say, "Helen, Helen." At the end of the garage, turn the opposite way. He's got I'll just let Tony Todd handle it. He's got the better booming voice here. Let's listen to a clip and get our first shot of Candyman.
"Do I know you?"
"No. No. But you doubted me."
"I'm sorry, I have to go."
"No need to leave yet."
"But I'm late."
"You are not content with the stories, so I was obliged to come." "Be my victim. Be my victim. I am the writing on the wall, the whisper in the classroom. Without these things, I am nothing. So now I must shed innocent blood. Come with me."
Ah!
Andy, you get the pleasure unpacking this one for us. First thoughts on Candyman.
Well, you definitely get the difference between him and the thugs that are pretending to be him. He just has this unearthly presence about him, you know, with that fur-lined coat and those pants, you know, those, I don't know what you call those pants, but, you know, just his presence, you know, just, you know, this isn't like just the thugs that she encountered earlier. And then just, you know, to have him tell her that, you know, just the stories weren't enough, so I had to come and show you that I was real. And that's just really, that's really frightening to think about. Yeah, if you like go, you know, look into some of these legends and you find out that they're true, that's a scary thought. And then the whole idea, you know, she wakes up, she's covered in blood and she's in this woman's apartment, and you know, and what's happened there is just like that's scary in of itself. You wake up and you're somewhere, you don't know where you're at. You're like, just the idea of not being in control of yourself, you know, especially when you wake up, you know, in that situation, you have no idea how you got there. It's really intense. I liked it though.
Yeah. Dave, could this role be anybody other than Tony Todd?
Well, it damn sure couldn't be Eddie Murphy, and I'm sure you're going to bring that up at some point in time. But man, Kyle, the funny thing is to think that Tony Todd wasn't really a big name at this point. I mean, we're all horror hounds. We love horror movies. So Tony Todd's always a big name to us. Some people probably don't even know who he is. But at this point in time, the biggest thing he had done was the remake of Night of the Living Dead, in which he was amazing. But just seeing him, it's kind of like Robert Englund. Like when he portrayed Freddy Krueger and the idea that it was just supposed to be a stuntman, like that became his identity. And then when Tony Todd steps on the screen and he just delivers the first line, you hear what Candyman is supposed to sound like. And then you just see how menacing he is. You know right there that they had cast the perfect person and that nobody's going to be able to fill those shoes, which is why here we are, 2018, and I'm glad they haven't remade it yet.
Yeah, so my interesting fact was the role of Candyman turned Tony Todd into a horror icon, but he wasn't the only actor in consideration for the role. Eddie Murphy was reportedly a contender for the part. It's unclear on exactly why he wasn't cast, but, you know, it could be anything from him only being 5'9", Tony Todd 6'5", to his salary demands. But, man, could you imagine Eddie Murphy just with that first line just being like, "Hey, bitch, what's going on? You didn't believe I'd be here. I'm here now." It doesn't work. Helen finally comes to, and as we hear at the end of the clip, we just hear screaming. She's laying in a pool of blood. We have no ideas if it's hers or somebody else's. She doesn't know what's going on. We hear a woman screaming still. She goes into the living room area. We see a dead dog's head laying on the ground, pretty brutal. She opens up the door and Anne Marie is crying over the baby bed, and the baby's not there. She charges Helen, accusing her of murdering the baby. They fight back and forth on the ground. Helen gets the upper hand and she grabs some type of meat cleaver in her hand. The police enter and wow, things are starting to really pick up here about halfway through the film. JD, what'd you think of this scene?
This scene is kind of nuts. Like, it's really kind of brutal to watch. Like, it's very disorientating. You don't know what's what. You don't know how she got there. Like, everything about this scene is just so unsettling. Like, it's a really good scene. I'm glad you called on me, teacher.
Next, Helen is getting strip searched at the precinct. We have a shot here of her just still covered in blood. The detectives tell her that she's under arrest. They read her rights. You know, this is a pretty scary moment for Helen. Dave, you know, kind of take us through this a little bit on and just catch our audience up on what's going on here.
Yeah, so Helen is a victim of wrong place, wrong time. And like Andy said, she didn't have a choice in the matter. And so now they're looking at her as a murderer. And she is just living with the grisly images. And like JD said, everything's chaotic. And I mean, I guess it was nice that it was a female cop strip searching her, because I know that could get really awkward really fast. But yeah, I haven't been in that situation, so I can't speak for it. But I can only imagine how terrifying it is to not only have to try to justify, you know, that you didn't do it, but then also wonder what it's going to be like in jail while you're waiting.
Helen makes her phone call home to Trevor. He doesn't answer, so she has to leave a voice message. She asks the guard what time it is. She says 3 a.m. In her jail cell, she has a dream and sees the baby sitting on a wall. and Candyman is bringing a beehive towards the baby. Helen's husband arrives at the jail cell next. He posts bail, and they go back home. Her husband and the lawyer think they have a shot at finding the baby, but if not, they're going to be charged with attempted murder or first-degree murder. She says that she blacked out, she can't remember anything, and when she woke up, she was in that place and there was blood all over. Andy, at this point, do you think Helen's the one that killed the dog, or was she possessed to do so by Candyman?
That's an interesting question, because, I mean, those thoughts, like, I was thinking about this as I was watching this movie. I mean, this could possibly be all in her mind, like, her seeing Candyman. And, I mean, obviously, it's not, but kind of the way they lay it out, it's very psychological. So there's always that question. It's like, is she the one that killed that dog? And, you know, as we see later, some other things happen, but I think they leave that ambiguous, but I like it because it leaves that question there for us to kind of think about.
Later that evening, Helen is just out of the bath. She cracks a Budweiser, lights up smoke. Hey, JD, what's your favorite beer and why is it Bud Light Lime?
Dude, you know I don't drink beer.
That's not proof.
Does Zima count?
I could picture you drinking a Zima.
I've got one in the fridge. You want me to crack it open?
Crack it open. Helen's going through all her photos next on the projector. She sees something in the photo after putting it into focus, but it's kind of hard to make out. She pulls open the blinds and then walks over to the bathroom mirror. When she opens up the mirror to grab something from the cabinet, Candyman's hook and arm come through the cabinet. She runs to the hallway and he cuts her off there again. He again asks her if she now believes in him. She doesn't say if she does or not. He says, come with me to be immortal. Outside, she hears Bernie outside the door and she tries to tell her to leave and to go. She finally yells, Bernadette, go! But she enters anyway and sees Candyman, and we hear the horrible sounds of her getting murdered. Her husband enters only to find her with a knife in her hand. Dave, what'd you think of this scene?
It was a pretty cool setup, not for her, but it reminded me, again, of more Nightmare on Elm Street throwback where, you know, Freddy Krueger's chasing the one girl, and then when she gets away, he appears right in front of her again. Same thing with Candyman does, you know, out of the bathroom mirror, then in the hallway. Just reminding you that he is a supernatural force, and he's going to be there no matter what you do. So you might as well listen to him, but she doesn't, and she's still trying to run away in. In the midst of everything, she ends up getting blamed for murdering her best friend. And I like what Andy's saying, too, because that also had crossed my mind, because when they made Child's Play, originally that script was written where they wanted you to have to decide if Andy the kid was doing it or if the doll was doing it. And so you see some of that in this film, too, because you're like, she didn't have a knife in her hand when she, you know, blacked out. Now she wakes up with a knife. Did she really do it? Or is Candyman having all the fun and just handing over the knife? And luckily, this scene kind of clears a little bit up because you hear Tony Todd in all his horror.
And I love the Child's Play reference. That would be another good one for us to cross-promote and do one and two.
Oh, I'm totally down.
Yeah.
We're still in the apartment. This time she comes to again. She runs out to the kitchen and we see Bernadette dead on the floor. Yeah, we have a really cool voiceover from Candyman here again, just saying that we see the baby in the dark room, and then she's being rushed to the hospital next. Her husband isn't saying much, but the look on his face kind of says it all, and I don't know that he believes her anymore. They tie her down to the bed and strap her ankles and wrists. She asks them not to leave her by herself, and of course, Candyman shows up right away when they do. He wants one exquisite kiss. She yells that he's under the bed. The nurses come in, and they just shoot her up, and she passes out. Andy, what'd you think of this scene?
It's really frightening to think about, you know, being, you know, taken into like this mental hospital, because it just kind of confirmed, because I'm sure she's already thinking, you know, wondering if she's crazy or not. And then just to be like put in a straitjacket or strapped down to a gurney. And then she's continuing to see Candyman. He's like continuing to be there. But nobody believes her. You know, that's just a really powerless, frightening situation to be in. You know, everybody just thinks you're this crazy woman that's murdering people, but then like you're wondering it yourself probably. But yeah, it was a good scene, especially like with Candyman like floating down towards her, and then when she like starts yelling, he just kind of floats to the side and floats down like down below the bed, and you don't see anymore. That's, man, this movie really reminds me of, like, Wes Craven. I think Dave was saying, like, this feels like a Wes Craven movie, almost more than like a Clive Barker movie. It was a great scene.
We have a quick scene here with Candyman feeding the baby honey from the bee's nest. And then we cut to Helen waking up. She wants to know where her husband is and where they're going. The nurse is being smart here. He's, oh, we're going to Disneyland. She's taken to meet Dr. Burke. She guesses that she's been committed. He tells her that she's been here for the past month and she's been under heavy sedation. They're assessing whether or not she can stand trial, and he explains that she's facing first-degree murder charges. Dave, what'd you think of this scene?
It's pretty interesting because one thing that I now wish I could go back and pay attention to is you talked about when we watch the video and we don't see Candyman, but yet you have to say his name in front of a mirror. Do we actually see his reflection? Because it doesn't show up in the video.
No.
But so he doesn't appear in front of the mirror at all, even though he's there, right?
Right.
It's an interesting sequence because it kind of solidifies the true horror of the mind. And I guess there's nothing scarier than isolation. And she's already in deep water. She's already committed. She didn't even know she's been there for a month. We didn't even know as an audience it had been a month.
Right.
And as we get into the story, we'll learn that a lot can change in a month. But I know just thinking about what that could mean, that is terrifying because, you know, sitting down for an hour and a half movie seems like a long time. You know, missing 30 days of your life, I mean, her marriage could be in shambles. You know, her job could be gone. Pretty much she's going to have no friends. Her best friend's already dead. But just the idea that she has no concept of time. And she didn't even get to go to Disneyland. What the hell's that about?
That's rough.
I just want to make the comparison to both Jacob's Ladder and then Slaughterhouse-Five in terms of that absence of mental perception when it comes to time. Like, it's just such a great way of using a literary device to create chaos between the viewer and the audience and the writer and the actors. It's like, I agree with everything that was just said. Like, it's a really great scene.
So she tells Dr. Burke that she can prove that Candyman's real and she can call him. She stares at the mirror and says Candyman 5 times. Nothing happens at first, but right when the doctor is going to be like, see, you know, you're going nuts, Candyman appears and murders Dr. Burke from behind, putting the hook right through his chest. He says, now you're mine. Our congregation will witness a new miracle. He pulls out the hook and undoes the straps on her chair and then jumps out the window. Helen follows him out the window as nurses run to the room, and she breaks through a window, knocking out a woman a couple windows down, steals her clothes, and escapes from the hospital. JD, what do you think about the escape and the death?
No, I love the way that we're still dancing the line between, you know, reality and perception. And even at this point, I was kind of like, wait, I don't know which way to believe. Now, like, I'm leaning towards like a 12 Monkeys kind of a vibe where I'm like, is this happening? Is this in her head? Like, this clearly is real now, but at what cost? You know, like, I don't know. Like, I appreciate the way that this sequence of events fucks with your mind.
So she arrives back at her apartment to find it being painted by another woman. She asks the lady to get out of her home. When Helen's husband enters, she wants to know when he was planning on telling her about the other woman. You can see Trevor is pretty scared to death here of her, and for good reason. I mean, she's killed pretty much everybody that she's been around lately. Andy, what do you think of this scene? You know, kind of just going off the fact that a month has gone by, she returns home, he's moved on, and they're repainting the entire apartment.
I think, you know, him moving on was in the works even before she went to the mental hospital. And, you know, that Trevor guy, he's such a creep. And, you know, you could tell that he was already having something going on with that student before Stacy is her name. But the scene is really heartbreaking because Trevor was like the last person that she had. She was really counting on him to be there for her, you know, when she went there to talk to him. And now that he has betrayed her, turned his back on her, she has nobody. And man, that's just got to be a really depressing place to be, to where like the only person that wants you is Candyman.
Yeah, and that's exactly what he's saying in the next scene. She's kind of looking over a bridge, staring down into Lake Michigan, when we hear his voice saying, They will all abandon you, and all you will have left is my desire for you. Later that night, she's back at Cabrina Green in the projects. She enters the room where she believes Candyman might be, with nothing more than a tiny flashlight. No weapon, no way of defending herself. Helen enters the room to find Candyman sleeping on a table. He opens his eyes right as she tries to stab him, and he tells her to surrender now and the baby will be unharmed. He picks her up in his arms, walks her over to a table, and tells her not to be afraid of death. She will be immortal if she comes with him. He opens up his jacket and his mouth, and hundreds of bees come out all over his face, all over her face. He says, "You're mine now. It's time for a new miracle." He grabs the baby, and then Helen comes to, and she's totally unharmed. No bee stings anywhere. And on the wall, it says, "It was always you, Helen. It was always you." Dave, what'd you think of this scene here?
This was one of the best scenes of the movie, even though I kind of was like, really? Candyman's just sleeping on a table there? When I had read about the casting of Tony Todd, something that he said completely stood out to me. He said that when he was trying out for the part, that he basically did it because he wanted to have his own version of Phantom of the Opera. And I think that that truly shines, especially in this sequence. Like, throughout the movie, he's very suave. He's, you know, he's not really running or anything. He just carries himself along. He knows that in the end, he's going to get her and he's her Phantom. But it's in this sequence that, you know, he takes her in his arms. He cradles her. And, you know, even though he's got a mouth full of bees, he still lays one on her, you know? And I just think that only Tony Todd could have really shown, like, compassion in this scene, but also be terrifying all in the same.
By the way, Phantom of the Opera, great episode. Check it out on Dave's podcast. Shameless plug. Helen goes outside. We see a big dumpster pile of junk, and she hears a baby crying as she starts going through the trash. We see Jake the young boy, and he says, "He's here." Helen finally gets to the baby, and Candyman grabs her from behind. He says, "I knew you'd come." The Cabrina Green residents start to burn the trash pile and chant, "Burn, burn, burn." Helen grabs a wooden stake and hits Candyman with it, starting to burn him. He yells and then starts knocking stuff over, which ends up falling on her back. She catches on fire, but crawls out safely with the babies. The residents kind of put her out, pat down the fire, but her hair is completely burned off. And we see Candyman in the fire yelling, "Come back to me," as he's engulfed in flames. JD, what'd you think of the ending of this scene here?
It's a cool set piece. It's a cool opportunity to bring community together and establish who Cabrini Green is and what they're battling against, you know, from hundreds of years of oppression. And I don't know, like, it's a little corny, but at the same time, it's visually pretty neat, and it fits in with the narrative that I think Clive Barker originally was trying to establish.
We're at Helen's final resting place. She's being put into the ground. Trevor looks on as the priest reads her eulogy. In the distance, they see the people from Cabrina Green coming to pay their respects to Helen, including young Jake, Anne Marie, and baby Anthony. Later that night, Trevor is in the bathroom. His girlfriend wants him to come out and eat dinner, but he refuses to come out, and she's kind of fed up with him here. She's throwing a little bit of a fit, and he has a flashback of Helen making him dinner and rushing to the door when he comes home. He puts his head up against the mirror, and he says "Helen" 5 times, and she appears with Candyman, and Trevor gets murdered in the bathroom here by Candyman. The girlfriend goes to the bathroom door, and he's just a bloody mess. She screams, and the credits roll. Dave, final thoughts on this last scene?
Amazing. So I was so glad that this didn't have a Hollywood happy-go-lucky ending, because it shows a closer reflection of kind of like what we've been talking about the whole time with the psychology, and even with the girlfriend that he has now. I mean, what poor taste. She was at the funeral. Like, she didn't really need to be there. She doesn't know her like that, you know? And then to show that now we're seeing the grass was greener on the other side, and he's remembering that he had the perfect wife at home. And I remember thinking back to the same thing, that, you know, when he came home, she had made that I think it was like an Italian dinner or something. She's kissed him on the cheek. Everything was ready. Like, he had it made and he just threw it all away. And then, yeah, you should feel like shit. Like, you deserve what you get. I'm not saying you should be hooked, but at the same time, I thought it was a really cool take to give us a really good horror movie ending and set it up for potential sequels.
Andy, what'd you think of the overall tone of the film and just going back and rewatching it here?
Yeah, the overall tone, it was very kind of nightmarish, very dreamlike. I felt the scenes in Cabrini Green were very surreal. Even like the big trash pile, you know, that there was something about that was like really off-putting. I think, you know, something about like being buried in trash or something like that is kind of probably a horrible way to go, especially being burned alive in a trash pile. But it was great to watch this again. It was a little bit slower than what I remembered. And like watching it now, like as opposed to when I was a kid, you kind of appreciate some of the style to this movie more, you know, and it does have more substance than just a average slasher movie. So yeah, it was great.
JD, I'm almost afraid to ask, what did you think of the overall film?
I'm not going to disagree or agree with what anybody said. I think that there is a lot of heart into this movie, and I think the message and the story is told very well. I think the music is phenomenal. The acting is fantastic. We can all agree on all of those. I really think that movies that came out in this time frame, you know, we're talking between 88 and 92, really didn't necessarily know how to create a movie that would have lasting impact on future audiences. And if we were discussing this movie, what, shit, 26 years ago? I think this conversation would be much different. And I think we would all be on the edge of our seats, like blowing our hats off into the ceiling.
That's a fair point. I mean, I can imagine being in 1992 in the theater watching this and, yeah, probably thinking this would be really scary in theater. Well, that's going to wrap up part one of the Candyman crossover episode with Andy and Dave from Black Cat Shadow. You're going to want to tune in for episode two, and you're going to have to do that over on their podcast. So make sure you find Black Cat Shadow on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, YouTube. Throw those guys a subscribe. While you're at it, subscribe to Dave's podcast, Dave's Pop Culture Podcast, and follow both of their shows. It's a great podcast, both of them. I highly recommend it. Dave, let's tease episode two real quick. What do you look forward to most when we jump into Candyman, Farewell to the Flesh?
So the biggest thing for me is I was really excited about this because I remember liking the first two. And I think as growing up, I actually liked the sequel more because they do a lot more backstory, but I haven't seen it in such a long time. So it's going to be really great to see if the same rule applies to where, hey, I really like this movie more. It's more fast paced, or now if it's going to stand out as a lesser quality film. So it'll be interesting to see if this is where a sequel surpasses the original or if I just had nostalgia blinders.
And then, Andy, after we come on to the show for part two, what else do you guys have coming up the next few episodes? Anything you want to plug our audience might be interested in listening to?
Yeah, sure. Thanks. Coming up in July, we're going to be putting out an episode talking about an old TV series called The Night Gallery. It was created by Rod Serling, who created The Twilight Zone. So, and on that episode, we're joined by The Fright Club. So it's going to be a really fun episode talking about a spooky anthology show from the 70s. And then we also have an interview with a independent filmmaker. It's a movie called The God Inside My Ear. And it's a really interesting movie. So, and it was a really interesting interview, just a view into independent filmmaking. So yeah, definitely check those out.
Yeah, and make sure you guys follow them on Twitter. Andy runs the one at Black Cat Podcast, which is their Black Cat Shadow page. Dave's at Phantom Dark Dave. We're, of course, at Back in Time Pod. And it's that time of the episode to climb back into DeLorean, punch in today's date, and return back to present day. We'll talk to you next week or over on the Black Cat Shadow podcast. See ya.
We hear you're looking for Candyman, bitch.